It's Thursday, September 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Pope Francis is here in Washington, and we bring you the latest on his visit.
There is good news that Israel is the strongest country 1,000 miles around Jerusalem, from Tripoli in Libya to Tehran, including these two capitals. So Israel, to the best of my judgment, can act.
A former Israeli prime minister shares his thoughts on the Middle East. Also ahead, oil prices continue to move and vocal distress becoming a big concern among singers. It's all on today's International Edition. With church bells ringing joyously and thousands cheering, Pope Francis arrived Wednesday afternoon in Washington, D.C. on the grounds of the Catholic University of America to lead his first Mass in the United States. Shouts of Papa Francisco rose as the pontiff waved to throngs from his Popemobile in a motorcade that wound through the Washington, D.C. campus. The Mass was delivered in Spanish and was held outside the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. At the beginning of the service, Francis conferred sainthood on an 18th century Spanish missionary who spread the word of the Church in what is now California. Earlier, the Pope paid a visit to the White House, where VOA correspondent Aru Pandey described his meeting with President Obama to International Edition host Sarah Williams.
In terms of the president, the White House, and he himself talked about today his deep admiration and respect for this man and how this man has inspired so many people, not just Catholics, people of all faiths, not just Americans, but all over the world. And one thing that was really that really struck, I think, everyone here is the fact that both of these men, both of these world leaders, talked about their shared values. If you listen to President Obama, he talked about how the Pope has reminded us to stand up for justice and against inequality, to basically lift up the poor. And this is a value that President Obama has also spoken out against, making sure that social equality and social justice is there for everyone. So this theme of shared values between these two leaders was pretty big. Both leaders talked about protecting religious liberty, protecting the rights of religious minorities. And then one huge theme, obviously, was the fight against climate change. You heard the president say that the Pope reminds us to protect our planet. And the Pope spoke at length about how President Obama's initiative to fight climate change was very encouraging, and that, you know, we should be mindful of the type of world that we leave to future generations.
And I thought it was interesting that the Pope began his remarks by identifying himself as a son of an immigrant. And of course,
that's
immigration,
right,
is very controversial, not just in the United States, but around the world at the moment.
Right. I mean, he struck, from the very beginning, he struck a tone of humility. And he followed that up talking about the importance of tolerance and inclusiveness. And I think that speaks to what not only what's going on in the United States in terms of the immigration issue, which has been going on for years, but obviously worldwide with the crisis in Europe and the people who are basically leaving their homes in the Middle East for a better life. So he talked about that. He talked about being the son of an immigrant, as you said, and of also being inclusive and really being there and showing compassion for those who need help.
Aru, what was the reaction of the crowd who saw the Pope arrive at the White House?
Well, we've seen so much buildup about this Pope's visit and how he's considered the people's Pope, and you really saw it. There were some 11,000 people, invited guests, on the South Lawn, and they were all there kind of saying the same thing, that this is the most approachable Pope that we've ever had. One woman said, "I'm Catholic, but I'm Catholic more so now because of Pope Francis." They talked a lot about how he speaks out for the underprivileged, and they said he feels the pain of every single human being. We're blessed to have a Pope like him. One woman stood in line, I think, for 6 to 8 hours, and she said it was worth it. It was amazing to hear his words and the way he has lifted up so many communities around the world.
Well, we go now from the White House to our lovely confines in Studio 22 to continue with the papal visit and check out what people are saying about his first U.S. Mass online. Our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here to bring us the latest. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. The historic Mass is ongoing as we speak, and it's taking place at the Catholic University, and its Twitter handle is @CatholicUNIV. The account is actively sharing tweets about the papal visit, and here's an example. The media outlet Catholic News Service is on Twitter at CatholicNewsSVC, and it sent out this tweet about an hour ago. Canonization of hashtag Syrah is outside Basilica, where Catholic University has its graduations. Hashtag Pope in D.C., hashtag Pope in U.S.
Well, that's referring to the Spanish missionary, Junipero Serra, who, how often are these last two hashtags being used?
Jim, nearly 105,000 tweets used hashtag Pope in D.C. in the last 24 hours, and that's, of course, according to the Topsy Analytics website. And less than half of that number of tweets used hashtag Pope in U.S., with around 45,000 people using that hashtag. Jim, I told you yesterday that hashtag Pope in D.C. generates an image of the Capitol, but I also realized today that hashtag Pope in U.S. generates an image of Pope Francis with the American flag in the background. Have you seen it?
Oh, yes, I have. Okay.
It's adorable, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Now I see. Any tweets about the homily, G?
Well, they are slowly flooding Twitter. But not surprisingly, the Catholic News Service is very quick with the updates, and here's its first tweet about the homily. Hashtag Pope Francis at Canonization Mass. Believers are called to rejoice and not settle for just being comfy.
Well, I'm sure we'll see more tweets about the homily tonight. Mm-hmm. Before you go, can you tell us about the U.S. government's reaction?
Sure, the White House tweeted a quote by the Pope earlier today, which Aru mentioned in the previous Q&A. As the son of an immigrant, I'm happy to be a guest in this country, which was largely built by such families. Now that tweet has been shared nearly 2,400 times and marked as a favorite nearly 2,800 times.
That's a lot. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that analysis. Our social media guru, G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter by that very same name, at G. Abby Lee. And you can also follow our VOA International Edition account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak offered a strategic approach to a deal with the security challenges in the Middle East, and during a discussion at Harvard University, he noted that Israel shares profound common interests with Turkey and many Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt, to fight radical Muslim terror and the hegemonic intentions of Iran, including its nuclear aims. Senior Middle East reporter for International Edition, Mohammed El-Shanawi, followed the discussion, which entailed his vision of solving the Arab-Israeli conflict. Mohammed, the Obama administration has tried so hard to restart the Palestinian-Israeli talks, but apparently has not made much headway. What's new in the Ehud Barak strategy?
Well, while he is standing in favor of a two-state solution, Ehud Barak believes strongly that it could come through a comprehensive approach to collectively tackle all the security challenges in the region, which he said is going through a geopolitical earthquake.
So all the threats are there. But there is good news that Israel is the strongest country 1,000 miles around Jerusalem, from Tripoli in Libya to Tehran, including these two capitals. So Israel, to the best of my judgment, can act out of strength and self-confidence to change the reality, its bad reality, to enough to propose. getting into this regional summit or international conference and be ready to discuss issues. Palestinian issues should be the first table, because all the neighboring leaders, the moderate autocrats, they agree with us about the priority of the threats of Iran and radical Muslim terror. But they cannot push these common interests to the surface because they are afraid of the response of their own streets.
Ehud Barak acknowledged that without starting with a serious effort to achieve the two-state solution, the regional actors will not cooperate in any of the other issues.
Mohammed, I understand Israeli leaders ignored the Arab League peace initiative that would exchange full peace for withdrawal of Israeli forces from Arab lands.
Ehud Barak admitted that Israel should have agreed with its own reservations to the initiative because it would gain a lot from entering into peace with the entire Arab world.
When it comes to the Arab world, we have a lot to get. It's recognition, it's participation in major projects, it's smoothing our efforts vis-a-vis the Iranians, and it is the starting point for a long generational process of Israel getting accepted by the region. So we have a lot to get from it, and Israel is much more tolerant to the idea of making daring steps vis-a-vis the Palestinians within the context of a regional agreement. We have to do it.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak said that Israel is strong enough to offer peace and without establishing a viable Palestinian state living in peace next to Israel, it would not be a Jewish state or a democratic state.
Mohammed Elshenawy, our senior Middle East correspondent. Mohammed, thank you for this insight.
Thank you for having me.
Asian stock markets sank Wednesday after a new report fueled more worries over the slowdown in China's vital manufacturing sector. Chinese manufacturing activity fell to its lowest level in over 6 years, that according to a preliminary version of a closely watched Purchasing Managers Index. The report adds to concerns over China's economic slowdown as Beijing is attempting to transition from an export-led to a domestic demand-led model of growth. On Wednesday, stock markets in Shanghai, Hong Kong, Sydney, and Seoul all lost around 2% by their close. That came after a heavy sell-off in the U.S. and Europe markets, and as investors are also concerned about a possible further devaluation of China's yuan currency, although Chinese President Xi Jinping on Tuesday pledged that this will not happen. He spoke in Seattle at the outset of his visit to the United States, and Xi said that Beijing plans to let the yuan adjust by market forces, saying there's no basis for continuous depreciation. Beijing's surprise devaluation of the yuan last month was seen as an attempt to spur economic growth, since it will make Chinese exports much cheaper in foreign markets. Oil has also dropped again. With more, we are joined from our New York bureau by economics correspondent Alexis Christophorus.
Energy producers slid as oil sank more than 3% to $44.71 a barrel. That's after a U.S. inventory report signaled lower demand. Raw materials producers also slumped after a reading on Chinese manufacturing fell to a six-year low. A government report showed U.S. refineries cut operating rates by the most in 8 months, signaling lower demand for crude as units are shut for seasonal maintenance. Oil prices have dropped more than 50% from their peak in the summer of 2014, pressured by a global glut of supplies and concerns about a slowdown in energy demand from China. Traders said goodbye to $100 oil prices a little over a year ago, and they might be staying away even longer than some expect. Top oil analyst Tom Closa at the Oil Price Information Service says it's difficult to make a case for $100 oil through the next few years unless there is a change in Saudi Arabia's policy of market share. Closa sees oil between $40 and $60 a barrel over the next 15 months. And looking much further forward, Closa was optimistic that higher oil prices are on tap in the next decade. Jim?
We also had some interesting comments about Europe's economic outlook from Mario Draghi.
That's right. The president of the European Central Bank says it is too soon to say whether risks to the economic outlook require more stimulus from the ECB. In his quarterly testimony to lawmakers in Brussels, Draghi said more time is needed to, quote, determine in particular whether whether the loss of growth momentum in emerging markets is of a temporary or permanent nature. He said officials need to assess the driving forces behind the drop in commodities prices and the recent global market turbulence. While ECB policymakers have repeatedly said the central bank is willing to bolster its bond buying program if necessary, some officials are reluctant to rush in. Draghi said the macroeconomic environment is, quote, more challenging, and vowed the ECB will not hesitate to act if risks increase. Similar to the U.S. Federal Reserve, Draghi's comments suggest the ECB is also having a hard time assessing the impact of slowing growth in developing countries. Jim?
We don't have to worry about dropping prices when it comes to great economic analysis. It comes to us free from New York and Alexis Christophers. Thank you so much, Alexis.
Thank you.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
European Union leaders gathered in Brussels Wednesday for an emergency meeting on the continent's vast migrant crisis. They're looking to tighten the region's borders while offering new aid to Turkey and other countries hosting refugees from the Syrian conflict. However, the EU heads of state remained split on how to cope with the thousands of asylum seekers streaming to Europe, even after their interior ministers adopted a country-by-country quota plan on Tuesday to disperse 120,000 migrants throughout the 28-nation bloc. Slovakia, one of four countries that voted against the quota proposal, said it would not accept any refugees and would sue to challenge the plan. Well, country singer Tim McGraw has had to cancel the last two shows of his current Shotgun Rider tour because of vocal distress. Trying not to distress his vocal cords, International Edition's Pete Heinlein spoke with VOA Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about McGraw's condition, which is similar to one that sidelined several top acts, including Little Big Town, Kelly Clarkson, Sam Smith, and Meghan Trainor.
Nikki, what's the story here?
Yeah, Tim McGraw's been added to the list. It's interesting. He's been on his Shotgun Rider tour since June, and it's been taking a toll on his vocal cords. Lucky for him, he doesn't have to have surgery. But the doctor has mandated that he cancels his last two tour dates. So he's been nonstop, but apparently he can't finish it. Not according to doctor's orders. He must rest. So the last two shows have been canceled. Hopefully they will be rescheduled sometime soon.
Boy, that's a tough one for us country music fans, especially.
Yeah. You know, I think that a lot of people, the industry really has to reevaluate its approach to touring. Because a lot of these artists, they're singing. They're not making money off of album sales, so they have to tour. That's how they're making the majority of their money. And they're doing like hour sets or 90-minute long sets. And they're taxing their vocals because they're doing these sets consecutively. Like, they're not getting the proper rest. If they smoke or drink at all, that also impacts their vocal cords.
And they do.
Yes, of course. Even if it's a glass of wine, it still does stress the vocal cords when you are singing that intensely on the road. And there is the incentive to just keep going because there's so much money riding on these tours.
We could have a little double wide planet in an empty field. We could have a big old white picket wrap around on a hill. Don't make a difference to me, baby, where the wind takes me, long as I'm with you, girl. We could have something or nothing, still be sitting on top of the world.
What's happening? I mean, Tim McGraw was here in town a couple of weeks ago and did a really phenomenal show.
Yeah.
what are the rest of his fans who are holding tickets? What happens to them?
Well, you know, it's a bummer for everybody involved. They haven't said when they're going to reschedule those dates. And I still think in the grand scheme of things, like Little Big Town had to cancel several weeks worth of shows. And his is just the last two shows of his final tour. So I think, you know, it's a bummer for everybody because people have to reschedule as far as artists and as well as the venue and everybody who's involved in making this show phenomenal as it is.
We remember how Adele came on the scene with that fantastic full voice.
Yeah.
And then she's gone.
Yes.
I mean, can she come back? I mean,
she's actually progress? Her new album is set to drop fairly soon at the end of this year. So she has recovered fairly well. But, you know, it's an excellent point. There's so much pressure on these artists to keep producing. So not only are they touring, but a lot of them are recording their albums while they are touring. So that even makes it worse. But as far as Adele's concerned, she took a break. She had her vocal surgery, and she's coming back this year. And Tim McGraw as well is getting ready to drop his next album November 6th called Damn Country Music.
Nikki Strong, always a pleasure to have you here. You can catch Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can also reach out to Nikki on Twitter at VOA_music. Thank you so much, Nikki.
Thank you.
Like we got love. Sitting on top of the world.
You've been listening to International Edition. We're always at our website, voanews.com. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Aydin Utku, for some great work today. And we thank you for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The loss of government control in countries such as Yemen, Syria, Libya, Iraq, and Nigeria's northeast is one of the factors leading to the emergence of radical and extremist terrorist groups, namely Al-Qaeda affiliates and ISIL. The United States, said U.S. Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism, Tina Cadenow, has stressed the need to diversify its approach to counterterrorism and to partner with other countries. One of the most serious aspects of the terrorist threat is the new phenomenon of foreign terrorist fighters traveling to conflict zones, most prominently Iraq and Syria. Another aspect to the threat is the potential for lone offender attacks by those who have been radicalized but remain in their home countries. Since the conflict in Syria and Iraq began, more than 25,000 foreign terrorist fighters from more than 100 countries have traveled to that region. There are reportedly over 250 Americans who have traveled or attempted to travel to Iraq and Syria to fight with ISIL and Al-Qaeda since 2012. While the numbers are troubling, the global community has mobilized to address the threat more effectively. The U.S. now has information-sharing agreements with over 40 international partners to identify and track the travel of suspected terrorists and is working on others. The U.S. is also encouraging its partners to increase security at their borders to better identify, restrict, and report travel of suspected foreign terrorist fighters. Ultimately, however, said Ambassador Cadenow, we need to do more than identify and stop foreign terrorist fighters from arriving at their destination. We have to prevent them from getting into these pipelines in the first place. To address this, the U.S. is working with partners both inside and outside of the government to increase outreach to youth, women, and victims in order to address the conditions that make communities susceptible to violent extremism. The best way to ultimately defeat terrorist organizations like ISIL is by expanding partnerships, building bilateral and regional capabilities, and promoting rule of law-based approaches to counterterrorism and violent extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.